Accession number 30419, reel 3.
And even in a tiger moth, you can pull quite a lot of G in a steep turn, particularly in an aerobatic manoeuvre. And I had quite a lot of difficulty with G, being 6 foot six. Okay. It's a long way from my heart to my feet, and a long way from my feet to my brain, so my blood would pool in my legs very easily, and I'd black out. Not in the tiger moth, I don't think ever, but in Jet Provost most certainly. But you also, G, when you've got G on in a tiger moth, it's quite an effort actually to keep your head up and looking at where you're supposed to be going, because it's being pushed down all the time.
There's so much to think about.
Yeah, there is. Then you do stalls, and then you do spins, and these are the frightening things.
I'm guessing these are the lessons you build yourself up.
Yes, that's right. You did them quite early on. You had to do stalls before you went solo. And spins, I think. I think you had to do stalls and spins. Of course you did, because you had to know how to recognise a spin and get out of it. So it was quite early on in the piece that you did stalls and spins. Good heavens, third lesson. Stalls and spins. So that was the day after we started. And the stall in the tiger moth is really very sedate. You close the throttle, keep the nose up, air speed drops off, and I think at about 37 knots, you lose flying speed, which means that the wings can no longer generate the lift to keep the airplane in the sky, and it drops, and the nose drops fairly ordinarily in the tiger moth. Some airplanes are terrible at stalls. The Concorde, for example. I wouldn't want to stall in the Concorde, but the tiger moth, fairly sedate affair. But because of the tractor, because of the torque on the aeroplane, on the propeller, you have to watch as it stalls, because the left wing would drop. So you've got to, recovery is to put the stick immediately forward and open up the power and climb away. You regain the speed and climb away, but you've just got to watch. You keep the wings level. But the important thing is to recognise the onset of a stall, because everything goes quiet and the controls start to judder as the airflow breaks down over the tailplane and the aileron. So, because if you were to stall in the final turn onto the approach, you'd be in trouble. If you were to stall on the approach before you got to the threshold and not recognise what was happening, you'd be in trouble. So it's very important to get that learnt early. Spin, a bit more exciting, because that's where you stall, but then you don't keep the wing up, the wing drops and you go into a spiral. And everything flies up out of the cockpit, because you pull a bit of negative G. The thing goes round like this, and there's a bit of negative G before you start spiraling down, and so all the bits of grass and straps come up, and everything clatters. If you've got slats on the aeroplane, they will clatter, and you spiral down. And this is very dangerous, because you lose height very quickly, and if it happens on the circuit that you go into spin, you've got no chance of recovering before you hit the ground. So it's important to recognise the onset of a spin, because if you're quick enough, you can get the stick forward and opposite rudder, which is the recovery, very fast. And that will bring the nose down and you regain flying speed. But of course, you're going down pretty well vertically. It's really the wing drop. The wing will drop very suddenly, and you haven't done it. It's done it itself. So you can tell if you've got flying speed and you're doing a roll or some aerobatic manoeuvre, you can make the wings go pretty fast, but in a spin it'll drop very suddenly. And you have no control. So the only way to get back control is to put the stick forward, centrally forward, full opposite rudder to the direction of the turn, full power, and climb, regain speed, and then climb away. It takes, I don't know how many feet it takes. It must take about 500 feet, I suppose, to recover in a tiger moth. So if you're in the circuit, you're in trouble.
So you had presumably you had a lesson where you just kept putting it into a spin and kept recovering.
Yeah. And then I was sick. I was sick in that lesson. And I think most people were. I mean, it was a pretty violent manoeuvre. And of course, fighter pilots did it all the time. It was an escape manoeuvre. They used to go into a spin on purpose. And aerobatics you can put into a spin on purpose, but never really liked doing it.
What comes next?
Oh, next, then you go for solo, I suppose, and it says here the takeoff and climb after the spin. So that's right. Once you've got your stalls and spins and you've done it, you practice them from time to time. But then you've got straight and level, you've got turns, and so you can come and practice the takeoff and climb and the landing.
Yes, we talked about landing.
Yes, landings are great fun because a lot of flying, you know, is terribly boring because you're going straight and level from one place to another, and once you've done that 100 times, boy oh boy. But
I've always wondered that.
Yeah. And takeoff every takeoff is thrilling, but it's over very quickly and then you're climbing away. But landing, you're actually doing something. It is, by statistically speaking, as I understand, the most dangerous stage of any flight. And you've got to get the airplane on the ground in one piece. And you have to, because you can't get out of the airplane and walk away from it in the sky. And it is the stage which gives the chop, as they say, to more pilots than anything else on training, in that they cannot judge their height above the ground. And there's not an awful lot you can do about it if a bloke can't do that. Some people can learn it. I know I've been reading recently, I'm doing some research for another book, and I've got the memoirs of a wartime Dakota pilot who learnt in Canada. And the only way he taught himself to do it was by external reference points. So when he was coming down and he knew that that hangar roof was at such an angle with that radio mast, then he had to round out and land. But that's pretty risky. You've got to use that only as an interim measure. You've got somehow or other to sort it out yourself. I was one of the lucky ones. I had no problems.
So it was just an instinctive knowledge.
You just knew. It's something to do with spatial awareness, I suppose. And I found it. The other thing that I also used with the tiger moth was the grass. Grass is a wonderful surface to land on because you can see it. You can get some parallax on the blades. That sounds a bit daft, but you can. You can tell the depth of the grass. You can tell the detail on the grass. And the other thing about landing the tiger moth is, of course, it does have this very high nose. So you can't see forward at the point of landing. It's one of the reasons I like to do a side slip landing, that you can look over the side until the last moment. But if you're coming down on a straight approach, your nose gets very high. So you're looking out over the side, and you can see when the grass is There, you can see the detail on the grass, then that's the time you're nearly there. But you have to watch it, because one or two times you're so intent on looking over the side, over the grass, that you're sort of leaning over and following it with the control column. Dangerous. So you come down with a bit of power on to keep a constant glide path. Then as you come over the threshold, you ease the power back. As you come down and you can see the grass, you're beginning to round out. You round out because the stick's coming further and further back as you're losing your flying speed. You're keeping it straight with the rudders and the ailerons. And then as the stick comes fully back into your stomach, you cut the power, 3 points. And I tell you, it's a lovely feeling when you hear the 3 points. You know you've got 3 points because the rumble starts at the back as well as the front. And sliding in a Tiger Moth on 3 points is another one of those satisfying moments in life. Then you go on and do advanced turning. And
how does that differ?
That's the steep turns. Those are the ones that I've talked about earlier, but it comes, obviously, you don't do those until you've done first solo. And that's where you have to pull the G, and you have to watch the fact that the rudder becomes the elevator and that kind of thing. The other thing is that you do actually turn around pretty quick, so it's more difficult to keep orientation, keep the lookout going, which you have to, and keep orientation with the where you are on the ground. Great fun. And then you do low flying.
That sounds particularly fun.
I don't think we did any low flying. In fact, I know we didn't do any low flying, except naughtily. I mean, the beat up after first solo, that was low flying. And you did fly low when you were doing forced landings. And forced landings sort of came in with low flying. Forced landings in the Tiger Moth, basic training, were something which you really needed to learn, because if your engine stopped, you had to land it. And with multi-engine, of course, you hope that you can fly home on the remaining engines, but the single-engine Tiger Moth, and they were very old aeroplanes when we flew them. I think 35 they were first was developed, the Tiger Moth, 1935, same age as this house. So it was the Gypsy Major, which was the engine, was extremely reliable. I never had any trouble whatsoever. But people did. Perhaps they ran out of fuel. And so you had to know how to land. So you were constantly flying, looking for a suitable place to land. It was part of the training. Always keep an eye open for what was a suitable place to land. Diversion airfields on the... We used to fly over Woodley, which was near Reading. That was the place where Douglas Bader had his accident, where he lost his legs, fighter station in the war. So that was an option. There was Blackbush not far away. There were airfields. But the most likely was a field, and the best was a stubble field. Once they'd taken away the hay bales, of course.
Is that fewer things to miss?
Yes, the stubble field. It was a nice surface to land on, I'm told. I mean, by the time there's stubble fields, the ground's pretty hard. And in September 57, there were a lot of stubble fields. So we used to... The instructor would close the throttle and say, you've lost your engine, land as soon as possible. And so you then had to sort it out, which way the wind was coming, because you wanted to land into the wind. So you were keeping an eye on smoke from chimneys.
There was... You want to land into the wind?
Airplanes always land into the wind. We're under the flight path here for London Airport, except when there's a westerly wind. We pray for westerly winds, because then they go and let down over my brother who lives in Kew. And when there's a westerly wind, no aeroplanes. When there's an easterly wind, they'll come over us and come in over the Queen and land that way. So you had to know which way the wind was blowing, and you did that from smoke from chimneys. There was much more in those days. And that was it. That was the only real pointer you could have for which way the wind was blowing. So you had to keep an eye open for that. You couldn't tell from which way the clouds were blowing because you were in them and going with them. You see what I mean? And so then you had to set yourself up in a circuit on this field, gliding down. So of course you could only do it by direction. You couldn't change your rate of descent. You had a constant rate of descent. So you had to weave around until you felt that you were in a proper downwind position, and then fly a downwind leg on the field and get yourself at a point at 500 feet turning into the field. And then you'd sideslip. And this was always fun. I always made sure I had plenty of height so I could be sure to sideslip. It wasn't just that that was fun, but it also, you were aiming the aeroplane rather like a dart at the end of the field, and you knew that you were just above the stall, so when you kicked off the side slip, you'd come in into the field. We never actually landed in the field, but by golly, we came very close. And so, and then you opened up and climbed away. Another thing you had to do on the glide down was you had to open up the engine from time to time to make sure that it would still respond when you got right down to the field. You could use that if you were clever, if you thought you were a bit low, to give yourself a bit of a boost, a bit more height. And we did a lot of these forced landing practices. And of course, we also did them on the airfield to make sure we could do it. So from time to time on our own airfield, we would do a forced landing. And you find out whether you really could land in that restricted area.
Testing your metal.
Yes. Aerobatics, we did aerobatics. I had a bit of... We used to do... in the Tiger Moth, you could do a barrel roll, and you could do a slow roll. A barrel roll is where you go round in a barrel shape, and a slow roll is where you do a roll round the axis of the aeroplane. I could do those all right, but not very well. If I put the stick across to the left, my knee would get in the way because the throttle was to the left of my knee and I couldn't get enough stick across. I could try them to the right, but if you roll a Tiger Moth to the right, you're going against the torque of the propeller. So I had a bit of trouble with slow rolls. And loop-the-loop, which was very interesting. I mean, you were well strapped in, but you had to remind yourself you were well strapped in when you were at the top of a loop with looking down at the ground. I think for a loop we had to dive to 120 knots, which is, the old wind was whistling for that. Dive to 120 knots, full power, pull back on the stick, and basically go around in a circle and hope you came out the place you went in. And we used to do stall turns, which was a fascinating exercise. That's where you go up in the vertical, power off, and then you kick on the rudder, and it basically feels like going into a spin, but you don't, because you're pointing straight down when you come out of it and you regain flying speed. But it's a hell of a clatter at the top of it with everything shaking around. And in that manoeuvre, you were in danger of the engine stopping because the Tiger Moth didn't fly very well inverted because of the carburettors. they didn't have injection on the engine, they used carburetors. And so if the fuel can't flow uphill, if you see what I mean. In a stall turn, if you lost your engine, then you had to restart the engine in flight. And this was another thing we had to practice, which basically consists of diving and letting the airflow restart your engine. But you have to have the throttle set to the right place, mixture rich, switches on, just as if you're starting the engine on the ground, and then you dive away. It always restarted. In my experience, it stopped twice for me, I can remember, and it restarted. And then that was it. We didn't do any instrument flying on the Tiger Moth. There was a way you could practice instrument flying, but you didn't need that for the PPL. And we did a bit of formation flying, just for fun. We didn't fly at night, but the instructors laid on a bit of formation, which is wonderful. I can remember enjoying that a lot later on, where you see another aeroplane flying alongside you in the sky, and it's really great.
Good company.
Yeah. And then the final test, to put all that together in the final test, as I said earlier, you did ran through the lot in the final test. It was just a 45-minute flight. 45-minute. The before it, the solo cross country was 1 hour 30 in the air, and this was 45 minutes in the air. You did stalls and spins, and after 13 hours 50, I got my private pilot's license and a set of silver wings, which I wore proudly on my RAF uniform back at the cadets. Yes, and of course, before being passed out, we had to take and pass a ground school exam. We'd done studies in air navigation and principles of flight and a lot of the stuff was what we sat through in those afternoons at Kingston Grammar School, so that came in useful there. And because to get the private pilot's license you had to pass that as well, which I think we all did. I don't remember any. There were about half a dozen of us who turned up for this flying scholarship. And a lot of people did it. A good few of the chaps I met at Cranwell later had done flying scholarships. One, a good friend of mine, had been at Fair Oaks, went to Fair Oaks the following year. And I have to say that the flying was the highlight of any flying that I did. It was just magnificent. And the Tiger Moth, I took up on the Tiger Moth in the 70s again out of Fair Oaks, did some more flying privately. I was a civilian by then, until Jenny, my wife, went up with me once, and then along came the second child, and I decided that it was silly to take the risks, and it was getting very expensive. And then on my 60th birthday, my daughter bought me half an hour on a Tiger Moth at White Waltham.
A lovely present.
It was magnificent, and I could fly the damn. I mean, I could remember the engine settings and everything else. They let me do the lady who took me up let me do everything except the takeoff and landing. The Tiger Moths are too precious for that, but I did everything else, and it came back. It was like riding a bicycle, and the thrill was still there.
Why do you like it so much?
I think it's the combination of the open cockpit, the biplane, the sound of the engine. It sounds a bit romantic, but it is. It's a romantic thing. The flying in the Tiger Moth is romantic. And a lot of the others was pretty humdrum. But every time you go up in a Tiger Moth, it's fun. That motorbike in the sky. So there we are.
You'd have this wonderful
Yes.
So what happened next?
Well, I was hooked. I was 17 and a half, so this must have been between, I was going into A-level years. So the plan was that I would do two A-levels and take a short service commission, and French and Spanish. I then got a letter, must have been pretty soon after, from the Air Ministry saying, dear Mr. Annett, we notice that you are too tall to become a pilot in the RAF. Thank you very much. I could have told them that. I mean, it was obvious, pretty obvious. I was above the height limits. I could cope, but not being able to do a slow roll to the left in a Tiger Moth, I mean, that didn't really matter, but be pretty restrictive in other aeroplanes. And so I was very disappointed. I had a short plan to go in the Navy instead, but realised that I would be even more uncomfortable in a destroyer than I would have been in an aeroplane. And so I started another A-level, English, and was going to Durham University. I got a place at Durham University and an open scholarship to go to Durham University to study economics. I didn't know where Durham was. I didn't know what economics was, but that was what the powers that be in the school had decided I should do. I have to say that career advice was pretty ropey and patchy in a grammar school in the 1950s. I said, oh, I'd quite like to be a dentist. Right, boy, you shall be a dentist. Well, of course, I had no aptitude for being a dentist. Anyway, I then had a spot of luck because the commandant at Cramwell, the guy who was posted to be commandant at Cramwell, Air Commodore Spotswood, was an old boy of Kingston Grammar School. And this same pilot officer, Dance, had the initiative to get in touch with Spotswood. The school felt a little bit equivocal about Spotswood because he'd been expelled. But that was not terribly well known, I suppose, but it felt they ought to do him a favour. So they invited him to speech day in 1959. And at the same time, Pilot of the Dance, I was 19 by this stage because I had to do 3 years in the sixth form to do three A-levels. Got in touch. Long story short, they were bringing in the Jet Provost, which had entirely different tolerances from the Vampire. My problem was the Vampire, which was the advanced trainer in the Air Force, was too small. Katie, you'd have a problem getting into it. And so, but the Jet Provost had much bigger tolerances. The Air Force was short of pilots, and the Commandant of Cranwell was an old boy of the school. So my uncle, God bless him, took me down to Farnborough, where I was measured to see whether I could fit into the Jet Provost. I could. Although I'm tall, I'm in good proportions. Well, I was very pleased because it seemed like a good deal to me. I didn't know Durham, I didn't know economics, and here was the opportunity perhaps to go to Cramwell, where I'd be paid and I'd start a career from the first day. I had to go and they took me to fly in a Jet Provost. I can remember I went up to Cramwell for the selection tests, which were very interesting. This was in the spring of 59, and we went to a place called Daedalus House, where we were put in overalls and led through the usual officer selection exercises. Right, lads, that's a ravine. You have this plank and this short bit of rope to get your team across the ravine. And they saw how you behaved in stressful and situations where you need to use initiative. the leadership of the group was passed amongst us and we all had a go. They must have thought I did all right. It was about a week we were there.